Hello and welcome to the Mission Junior podcast. And here as always, your host Girish Shivakumar. As usual, I'm pretty excited to bring to you yet another podcast episode. A quick announcement before we head to the feature segment. The International Podcast Day happens on September 30th of every year. And this year, I'm participating in an event in Bangalore on September 28th. The link to the event and other details have been regularly shared on the social media platforms of Mission Junior. So in case you haven't seen that, follow Mission Junior on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Go by the handle at Mission Junior. So now let's dive into the features segment, aptly titled Meet the New Meat. I'm sure it wouldn't come as a surprise to you when people tell you that meat consumption has a negative impact on the environment. So meat accounts for about 15% of the global greenhouse gas emissions annually, and the growth of meat consumption has been increasing year on year. So this week, we will look at the need for meat alternatives and the evolving policy and regulatory landscape from the major markets around the world. Hello, Laura. Welcome to the Mission Junior podcast.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Laura Willis-Lee is from the Chatham House in the UK, and she is the co-author of the policy paper Meat Analogues Considerations for the EU. The report was published in early 2019. So we will begin by looking at the background of the report that you published recently. Why do you think it is rather important for policymakers to look at alternatives for meat?
Well, the first point to make really is that we really need to be looking for ways to reduce global meat consumption if we're to stand a chance of meeting climate change targets and keeping global temperature rise below 2 degrees. And the reason why we're focused on governments and what governments need to do around the issue of meat alternatives is because they have a really key role to play in determining the future of strategies to reduce meat consumption, both to encourage more sustainable diets and to support innovative solutions that come along and that can accelerate that shift in dietary choices.
In terms of the impact, I'm sure the governments are looking at this because the impact of the meat industry as a whole for the environment is significant. So can you quantify the numbers that we are looking at?
Yeah, well, the meat industry as a whole accounts for an estimated 14.5% of human-driven global greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a really significant share. And it's interesting that you say that that's presumably the reason why governments are looking at this. Actually, to date, governments haven't really taken account of the climate impact of the livestock industry, partly because of how emissions are measured and accounted for. It's not really been seen as a priority area. That's starting to shift, but we really need that shift to happen quickly.
So what is the general trend of global meat consumption and what are the challenges faced by the governments?
Well, in many developed countries, particularly in Europe and in North America, we are seeing meat consumption levels plateau, but they're doing so at an extremely high level. So significantly above what's recommended as a healthy level, and significantly above what's a sustainable level. At the same time, in developing countries, we know that meat consumption is rising rapidly as incomes rise. Meat consumption also rises with it. And the UN expects to see a 15% growth in meat consumption just between now and 2027. So in the kind of 2030, 2050 timelines, we're really looking at significant growth in meat consumption. But it's been largely the scientific community and civil society who've really been pushing for governments to recognise that current meat consumption levels are a problem, that future meat consumption levels will be even more of a problem, and that business as usual trajectories in meat consumption are incompatible with internationally agreed targets to tackle climate change.
So you mentioned about the internationally agreed targets. I'm sure the Paris Climate Agreement is one such target. Was the study looking at this from that perspective, or were there more objectives to this study in general?
Well, the purpose of this study in particular, where we explored some of the considerations for EU policymakers around the growing industry in meat alternatives, was to think about what role meat alternatives can play, certainly in climate mitigation, but also in some of the other major policy priorities in the EU and around the world, actually, around improved public health, responsible antibiotic use, the circular economy, and in general, better environmental management, sustainable resource use. So it's in that broader context that we want governments to be looking at meat and meat alternatives.
The report definitely has some major recommendations for the governments. But what are the meat alternatives currently available?
Well, so plant-based meat is what it says on the tin. It's plant-based, so it is plant-based meats are made from plant-derived ingredients. They aren't meat per se. They are instead plant products that are aimed to mimic the look and texture and taste and feel of conventional meat as we know it, and really to be virtually indistinguishable from animal-derived meat. So they're slightly different to what's come before them in terms of the soy-based and the more kind of familiar, I guess, plant-based alternatives to meat. On the other hand, we have cultured meat, which is meat. It is animal-derived cells. So cultured meat is produced by taking cells from an animal and then growing those either in a laboratory or in a bioreactor to produce real meat and muscle fibers. So there's a big difference between the two, but what they're trying to achieve is really the same. It's to create a substitute for conventionally produced meat that doesn't require any kind of major compromise on taste or eating experience.
So business as usual will not help us meet the climate targets. So what are businesses saying? Wouldn't it be good to have the business perspective as well? So yes, I have another guest who is from the industry. Hi, Mira. Welcome to the Mission Shunya podcast.
Hi.
So can you begin by giving us a brief background about your work?
So I work for a nonprofit called New Harvest. It's a 501c3 nonprofit research institute based in Brooklyn, New York, that funds academic research in the world of cell-based food products. So applications of what is traditionally medical research, like tissue engineering, to agriculture.
Can you give us a background about the origins of New Harvest? How did it come about and what has it done over the years?
Sure. So New Harvest was started in 2004. And at the time, the idea of cell-based or cultured, or what is popularly known as lab-grown meat, was a very extreme kind of wacky idea. And so at the time, New Harvest's role was really to just try and convince people that cell-cultured meat is an inquiry worthy of pursuing. And dial back this kind of Frankenstein conversation around the idea. So fast forward to 15 years later, and now, I mean, it's in the news all the time. People consider it to be this viable thing, and they give it its appropriate due. So New Harvest is involved in creating the ecosystem, setting up the pipelines of talent and expertise necessary to sustain ongoing innovation in this broad field of cellular agriculture. So we seeded two companies, Perfect Day and Clara Foods, which are making milk proteins and egg proteins respectively from microorganisms, reprogramming them to make these animal proteins. And now we have a research fellowship program where we give academic researchers the additional funds they need to pursue these agricultural applications of, like what I said, is traditionally medical research. In order for there to be research in this pre-competitive way for the building blocks of this technology that's happening in an open access academic setting so that other people can iterate upon it as opposed to it being protected behind IP in a private company.
But looking at a broader picture, what are the impacts, like if you're making a pitch to, say, someone, a common man, what are the long-term impacts of the current animal-based nutrition that the world in general is following?
Sure. I mean, it's obviously very bad for the environment. The Amazon is burning, and that's because they're clearing land to grow more cows, to make more beef. Animal agriculture is just simply unsustainable for the land, for water. It just takes up an undue amount of resources, not to mention the fact that the whole industry is built upon maximizing efficiency with real living animals. And so that just results in cruelty in order to produce more meat. Whereas this is just circumventing the need for the animal's body at all. You're just growing the parts specifically that you need rather than growing a whole cow to take the bits and pieces that you're trying to eat or make shoes out of. You just grow the exact parts you need. And so there's no waste.
As Laura and Mira highlight the impact of current meat consumption, it has a pretty negative impact. Like the Amazon forest fires are attributed to the need to clear more land for cattle rearing. Most countries in the world are at crossroads, addressing the demands for a growing global population, like what Brazil is trying to do with the Amazon. But we also need to address the concerns for the environment, like the negative impacts that it has on the planet. And this calls for an effective policy making. So, as EU prepares for a mass adoption of cultured meat and the entry of disruptive startups, the report from Chatham House is at the right time. Or is it? Let's listen in. Do you think the timing of the study is very crucial in terms of where the industry is right now in the European Union? And do you think the timing of the study is right?
I mean, that's a really good question. I guess it, you know, you always would have liked to come to a particular conclusion or set out a set of recommendations early as possible. And particularly in this space, it's one that's moving extremely rapidly. That said, I think there is still a window of opportunity for governments to really take the chance to consider carefully what the implications of meat analogues are and how they fit alongside existing policy priorities, and really to get some really clear and robust processes in place for regulation and for policy. It's also an important moment for EU policymakers to take stock of what's happening elsewhere, so particularly in the US, where they're somewhat ahead of the game in terms of plant-based products being on the market, especially the Impossible Burger, and then, you know, challenges around regulation following that. So we've seen certain states in the US introduce laws to regulate the use of terms associated with meat, so things like burger or sausage, for plant-based alternatives. And the EU is only now starting to think about that as well and think about whether those kind of regulations are needed. So the EU policymakers will need to watch carefully what unfolds in the US, I think, and take heed of any lessons learned there.
US kind of went, as far as I know, had a smooth sailing until recently. What was the policy landscape before and after or until recently? How did this evolve?
So the policy landscape for plant-based things is entirely different from the policy landscape for cell-based foods. But there is a protracted debate over nomenclature, whether you're allowed to call oat milk milk. The dairy industry would rather you not call it milk because that obviously takes away sales from cow's milk. Same with meat. But also, as you see traditional animal agriculture companies kind of investing in this space and trying to make these products of their own, they have loosened up on this kind of hostile attack in this regulatory capacity because they've realized that consumers want this and they can make money from making it too. And it's in their interest to market it as milk if they're trying to make money from it.
While the policy for meat alternatives is evolving, there are definitely some parallels with regards to regulations for other food products, like the genetically modified food or the GMOs. So let's listen in to know how the European Union adopted to the GMOs and what are the lessons it can pick up from regulating meat alternatives going forward.
Yeah, I mean, GMOs is an interesting one, as you say, especially in the EU. And I think one of the key lessons from experience around GMO regulation is that, firstly, that public perceptions and consumer trust really matter as much as technical considerations in terms of predicting whether or not new food technologies will take hold. Food is a really personal and emotional issue. We've seen this through our previous research and research of many other groups. And consumers need to know that what they're eating is safe, for a start. So the government has a really central role to play in the context of meat alternatives, in ensuring rigorous safety testing and making sure that products are regulated and regulated properly. But what the GMO experience also shows is that I think government has a role to play in ensuring that consumers have access to balanced, evidence-based information on new techniques, new technologies, new food products as they come along. The information that's fed to the public in relation to GMOs and to meat analogues is often very conflicting and very confusing. And it's really crucial that we try and create a very clear information environment in which people can make their own choices based on correct information and based on evidence-based policy and evidence-based awareness campaigns and awareness levels, and just generally that there's an understanding at the individual level of what they're eating and whether it's safe and where it's come from.
Because the reason I ask this is food in general is a very highly regulated space. In other sector and other space, like for technology space, startups can find an easy path for commercialization. But food industry per se is very highly regulated, and the negative impacts, if something goes wrong in a new innovation like this, it could be tremendous. So what are the challenges faced by new innovators and new startups in this space?
The challenges, I can mostly speak to the challenges in cellular agriculture companies specifically. And in the United States, there's this thing as such as GRAS, generally recognized as safe. And recently, these animal protein companies have made a lot of headway in having their proteins generally recognized as safe, which is kind of the go-ahead for scaling up and commercializing. With meat specifically, there was a long debate over whether the USDA or the FDA would regulate it. The USDA regulates meat traditionally in the country, but the FDA generally regulates this type of technology, albeit in a medical space. And this is just an agricultural application of that same kind of medical technology that's generally regulated by the FDA. So that has posed this kind of particularly sticky question as to whether the FDA or the USDA would regulate it here in the United States. Right now, they're in this joint partnership situation, but that's a work in progress.
Talking of the policy environment, we should also look at the other factors in the ecosystem. For example, what are the different welfare groups and different activists saying about the policymaking in process? Example, what are the animal welfare groups saying about policymaking in this space? So what has been the impact of such organizations in terms of policymaking or in terms of the recommendations that have come out in this report?
Well, civil society groups, both around the environment and animal welfare, but also public health, climate action, have been really formative actually in laying the groundwork for innovation in meat alternatives and in bringing the issue of meat and its climate and environmental impact and its the public health impact of overconsumption really up the public agenda and the political agenda. So it's been those groups who've really made the case for governments to sit up and take notice of the livestock sector as a source of potential risks to environmental and human health. And it's those same groups who are keeping check on industry practice, not only in conventional meat industry, but also in the meat alternatives industry. So we've already seen some environmental groups push hard for cultured meat producers to move to low carbon energy sources to reduce the carbon intensity of their production, for example. And some animal welfare groups who've raised concerns with the use of fetal bovine serum in cultured meat production. So we're seeing continuing influence in terms of the direction of innovation in this space. They're also warning now, many of these groups, against overly restrictive regulation of plant-based meat. Really ensuring that there's a focus on evidence-based decision making, and that industry groups or interest groups from different quarters don't push for regulations that aren't fair or aren't necessary. And then that's where we come back to this question of consumers and labeling, and whether we have any concerns about consumers being misled by these new products and alternatives. I think it will be civil society groups who are really keeping check on that process in the EU as those questions are posed.
So how has activism helped the businesses? Has it enabled more consumer awareness and business opportunities?
Sure, that's a very interesting question. And obviously I can only speak to a US context for that. But so animal rights, kind of related to this multi-decade organic growth of interest in these products, there's also been animal rights activists and leaders and groups have played such an important role in awareness about the animal cruelty and even environmental violations of traditional industrial agriculture. And now it seems like everybody knows that factory farms exist, that our meat is coming from these confined animal feeding operations and the animals live a horrific existence. But that wasn't always the case. And it took these decades of animal rights activism to bring that awareness into the mainstream. So now that that is kind of a mainstream awareness, you see that now with these new products like Beyond Meat, the Impossible Burger, they're very deliberately not making an explicit animal rights appeal, even if that was maybe what motivated them to start making the product in the first place. The animal rights component has definitely taken a backseat on the production end because they no longer need to make such a kind of polarizing yet necessary appeal.
So how are you enjoying the podcast? I'm sure you are pretty excited to know more about this. And as you would expect, we had a lot more to discuss. So I'm splitting this as a two-part series. So coming up 2 weeks from now, it'll be more consumer-centric. The discussions will center around how the meat alternatives are perceived by the general consumers and what are the different kind of meat alternatives available. Also, there are a few people who'll come on show and describe how it felt to have tasted, say, an Impossible Burger or another meat alternative for the very first time. And you can also be featured on the podcast. So in case if you happen to have tasted a meat alternative, you can record it or send me a short voice memo from your phone. You can send it to missionchunia@gmail.com. Just give a brief description. How did you feel and what are your expectations from the product as you go forward? And if you're lucky, I'll feature that in the next podcast. So remember to send your audio recording to missionchunia@gmail.com. And like always, please leave a rating and write a review on Apple Podcast platform. It definitely helps in the podcast's discoverability. And make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you'll get the next episode when it is released. So until next time, signing off, this is Mission Chunia, towards a zero carbon economy.